from the time that they pronounced me dead was a good 45 minutes.
They cut my clothes and then they paddled my heart, because my heart had stopped. And I could see people screaming and crying, but I didn't realize that was actually my physical body because I was somewhere else.
The only thing that I could feel, if you could imagine, absolute love and peace. There wasn't anything else to be felt.
I was greeted by people I'd known in the past.
I'm back home again.
Incredibly safe and felt at home.
Welcome to Round Trip Death, everybody. And our special guest today, Deborah Yates. How are you, Deborah?
I'm doing really good, Eric. How are you this morning? Afternoon here, good morning there.
Well, for us, it's morning. For people living all over the world, and who knows what day they're listening to this, it's all kinds of the day, night, and et cetera. But you're in beautiful Florida in the United States. Tell us about where you live and what you do.
I currently reside in a little place called Bonita Springs, Florida. It's just a little bit north of Naples. A lot of people know where Naples is. I originally hailed from the Ohio Valley. Ohio means beautiful river in Native American, by the way. And almost every state in the United States is named after an Indian name. So if you're curious about what your state is, just go online and look it up. But I hail from Ohio. I was born in a little town called Cambridge, famous for the glass. And I was really just kind of born there. I was actually the first survivor that got to stay in the incubator that John Glenn donated to the hospital that I was born in. And then we just kind of moved around all over from there. My father was one of the first welders on the natural gas lines around the northeast part of the country. And he was so good, they were constantly bidding on him and luring him away. So every time we moved about every 6 months, just needless to say. And then we settled in a little town called Lexington, Ohio, which is just about smack dab in the middle of the state. I'm a retired landscaper. I was a landscaper for about 25 years. So I'm pretty well versed in plants, and I was a farmer as well, dairy farmer. And then I had about a 14-horse stable, show stable. So it was a lot of fun. I rode and trained horses for many years. Back in, I want to say it was 2009, I found myself having to get a divorce. I needed to move away because his crazy girlfriend decided I needed to be dead versus alive.
That's something for another podcast, that story.
Well, I hid for a year and a half.
Wow.
I moved every 3 weeks. Every 3 weeks I moved. Spent all my money, but I had a good time.
Some true crime podcast with that one.
Oh, yeah.
Anyway, I'm glad you're settled now. Everything's good, right?
Yes, it's beautiful.
All right. You knocked off the girlfriend instead, so.
I know. They're still happily ever after, living two doors down from my family home. Thank you very much.
Anyway, enough small talk. Our listeners are here to learn about near-death experiences. You've had all kinds of experiences in your life, including a couple of near-death experiences. So I'm going to jump back in time, just 3 or 4 years, to when you were 19 years old, okay? Give us an idea of what was going on in your life and what led up to what happened on that fateful day.
Well, it was in the 1970s, and, you know, as...
You did not have to divulge that.
It's okay. I don't care. I'm 66 years old. I'm proud. I can't believe I'm here. I mean, I've almost been dead 5 times. Dead twice. So it doesn't bother me to tell my age because it all shows, okay? I was dating a young man that was a basketball center. His name was Craig. He was like dang near 7 foot tall and gorgeous and young and beautiful. You know how that goes.
Not really, but go ahead.
He was handsome. I was beautiful and he was handsome. So anyways, we went down to Columbus for a night of partying, shall we say. Now, I'm not really sure what all happened at that party, if I was slipped something or how it exactly happened, but everybody was, you know, dancing around and having a good time. And my boyfriend, his nickname was Lurch, by the way, and he put on a scary mask and he had hands that went with the scary mask and he popped around a corner. And from what I recall, he went boop, 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 and put his hand on me, I went out. instant collapse to the ground. From that juncture, I can remember feeling like I was walking 6 feet off the ground, and I'm going, well, this is really interesting. I'm walking 6 feet off the ground, and I'm looking down. And then all of a sudden, I see my friend standing there, and I see somebody on top of somebody kind of like beating on them. I'm thinking, what on earth is going on? I guess when he raised up from what he was doing, I saw it was me laying there.
So he was doing CPR?
He was doing CPR on me. Yeah, I mean, I was dead. I was gone. I had no pulse, no heartbeat, no nothing. And, you know, the old saying, you know, he scared me to death. It was either that or drugs. I'm not really sure if somebody slipped me something that night.
Probably a combination is my guess.
It could very well have been. So anyways, I just was up there hovering above my body. And when I woke up, he was on top of me, beating my chest. And I opened my eyes and I said, what are you doing to me? Well, of course, the cheers went around the room because they had taken me from where I was and drug me to the middle of the room where he could work on me, because I was kind of in a hallway when the original incident happened. You know, it's like young. I was like maybe 17 years old and didn't even think about going to the hospital. I mean, I'm sure I was told to go, and I'm going, no. The next day, my chest hurt so bad. I was bruised from here to here. Just massive bruises where he had been literally pounding on me to get my heart started. So thank God James Boehner was, he was a paramedic in Vietnam.
He knew what to do.
He knew exactly what to do and brought me back, because I'm not sure if, who knows, you know, it was just, you know, God had his hand in everything. He had his hand on me going out, or somebody did, and he had a hand in bringing me back. So, you know, I can't recall anything other than the feeling like I was not walking, because I wasn't walking on the ground. It was the weirdest feeling, but yeah, it was a little interesting.
Well, you were outside your body looking down at it.
Yes.
That's a very unusual place to be. And just to remind people, every NDE is completely different from each other. So your first one was very simple and short, but also taught you something. We're going to talk about your second one in a minute, which has a whole bunch more detail. Did you feel like you learned anything from that first one?
I wasn't afraid of death anymore. I wasn't afraid of it. I wonder if my two younger experiences, of course, I don't remember the baby one, but I had a near-death experience at three, where somebody had, you know, attacked me and beat me up and was trying to drown me. And, you know, like I told you before, I remember looking out of that water, thinking this is the last thing I'm going to see, and thinking I needed an angel. And the angel came in the form of a 9-year-old girl that knocked that boy off my back. So I think I've always, you know, had a more spiritual side to me than maybe other folks, because even as a young child, I was visited frequently by, for lack of another word, ghosts, spirits, whatever you want to call it. I had an undeniable faith in God that was obvious to everybody that I knew. At 6 years old, I went to my pastor, six, almost seven, and told him I needed to be baptized. And he said, oh, no. And then at seven, between seven and eight, I went to him again, and I said, I need to be baptized. And he said, Deborah, you're too young. You're not at the age of accountability. And I said, you got to baptize me. You just got to baptize me. And so unbeknownst to me, there was a meeting set up, and my pastor and three other pastors from the Southern Baptist faith came to my home and questioned me. Well, I would have been in second and third grade. You know, there's no way I'd read the Bible, but I had details and knowledge that I shouldn't have had at that age. And at the end of that 1 hour meeting, they all concurred I needed to be baptized, that I most definitely was the age of accountability, that I understood the Bible. And I knew things that I shouldn't have known. I shouldn't have known a lot of those things they were asking me. But, you know, God has a way of working in your spirit. And I knew that I needed that confirmation that when I left this earth, that I was going to go be with the Father.
That's a good explanation. Let's jump forward just a few years to, wow, we just barely had someone on the show recently that had a horrible electrocution. You were electrocuted too. I guess that's the theme of the month or something. I don't know.
Yeah.
But tell us what happened. You were what, 24 years old now?
I believe I was right at 24. Yeah, it would have been 24. I had gone through a bad breakup again. The guy tried to kill me. Oh my God, this is the rhythm to my life. And he put me in the hospital for about 3 weeks. And when I came out of the hospital, I immediately packed up and I moved to Dallas, Texas from Lexington, Ohio. My girlfriend, you know, she opened her home to me and allowed me to move in. And, you know, I felt really kind of saved me because I just knew if I stayed, he would get me and kill me. So I moved in with her. And then my very first apartment, I'd been living there about 4 or 5 months at a beautiful place and had a great swimming pool. And I was an avid swimmer as a young person. I was on a swim team and dive team. So, you know, how when you do in laps, you do kick turns and you come off the walls. And I would go down and do about 50 every other day. Coming back on my last lap that I took, I think probably forever. And as I raised my hand up out of the water and looked, I could see what looked like a megaphone with wires sticking up on top of the water. It was just laying on top of the water. And my hand came down in it. It was too late to do anything. I hit it.
So let me make sure I can picture this situation. There was some kind of an electronic megaphone, microphone, speaker, whatever. How did it fall into the water?
Well, it wasn't. It would come unloose from the back in the long time ago. They didn't have wireless anything. And somebody had the screws worked out of the light fixture. It was actually a light fixture that had come out of the wall and floated to the top of the pool. And so when I hit that, everything went black, 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 black as can be. And I blinked my eyes a few times and I heard someone say, "Deborah, Deborah." And I looked up and it was my grandmother who had passed away about 7 years before that. She was my everything. I adored this woman just about anything more than anything in life. And she was my girl. I was her girl and she was my girl. You know, she taught me how to cook and not how to clean, but she taught me how to cook pretty good. You know, it's hard to explain. It didn't look like her per se in the face. She had on what I would consider maybe a robe, a whitish robe that with maybe like even a hood on. You know how people say the eyes are the window to the soul? I recognized her eyes. And then I could smell her. I smelled her. You know, we all have our own scent that we, you know, exude. I went, "Grandma." She went, "Deborah, honey, I miss you. I love you, but it's not your time." I said, "No, Grandma, I want to come be with you." And she says, "No, baby, you got to stay here. You got things to do. People need you." But I said, "Grandma, yeah, but I can't have babies or nothing." And she goes, "It's not your time." And that was the end of the conversation. And she took her arm and she went like this. And when she went across where my body was, that light let me go because I was getting shocked.
So you were paralyzed.
Yes.
Shocked to this thing. Yeah, it was explained to us in our podcast with Ryan just recently how your muscles completely lock up.
Well, they do.
And so you can't let go. I mean, we've seen this in the movies. It really happens that way.
It's true. You cannot do a thing about it. And as she moved her hand across like this, that thing let me go. It let me go just as quick as can be. And my arm flew around as my arm flew around, me and my whole body hit the side of the pool. I think I still have a duck from it right here. I swear. And it knocked me backwards about 15 feet in the water. I knew that I was alive again when I stopped because everything in my body hurt so bad. I mean, unbelievable, unbelievable pain. My brain went crazy. So at this point, I'm kind of still looking ahead of me because it knocked me straight backwards. And I'm still looking ahead of me and I can see that light going, zzz, zzz, zzz. It's smoking, it's sending up sparks and it's going, it's rocking in the water. That's the whole, the water was rocking. It was that intense of a thing that happened in that pool that day. So I started swimming towards the ladder and I got just about to the ladder and I heard, no, don't touch the ladder. So I veered to the side of it and I don't know how I did it. To this day, I'm not sure how I did this, but I got up on the side of the pool to my waist, and I was a strong chick back then. And I flattened up like a board and inched my way out of that, away from that walk. The man that was sitting there, well, he was asleep with earphones in his head, listening to music, I'm sure. He didn't budge. And because I was hollering for somebody to help me. So I got up and I went to the wrought iron fence that went all the way around the pool. So you got a fence and a pool, grabbed onto that fence and my body just racked and racked and racked. My body racked so hard that fence, all four sides, all the way back around to me, the whole fence was moving. I was racking that. I mean, I swear it was moving that hard.
Explain that. Were you still feeling electricity or were you just in so much pain that you were shaking it?
Yes, I couldn't let go of it. I could not let go of that fence for love or money. They had to pry my...
Wow.
The EMTs, the ambulance people, literally pried my hands off that fence. Because you know how those ornate wrought iron fences, they got the little pretty dealy-doos on them?
Yeah.
My hands were right below those, and I just racked, racked. I didn't stop doing this for I don't know how... I didn't sleep for a week. I couldn't fall asleep. Every time I'd even think about falling asleep, my body would jerk and jerk me right back awake. Anyways, come to find out later, there was two little girls. I did notice the two little girls after I was, you know, rocking the boat there. They went and got help. That's how I ended up getting help. I met the girls as one of the girls' mothers a few weeks later. You know, she came to check on me to, you know, see how I was doing. I said, did the girls notice anything? And she goes, no, they really didn't notice much, but they said you were talking a foreign language. And I said, a foreign language? She said, oh, yeah. And I said, what language? She said, they didn't know. They'd never heard the language before. And they go, well, do you speak a foreign language? I said, I knew. I can barely make sense out of English, let alone a foreign language. So I don't know if they heard me talking to my grandmother and that's what they heard. You know, they were little girls, probably 7, 8 years old, roller skating around. So that's about all I know about that.
That is insane.
The ambulance attendants did arrive. But like I said, they pried my hands off there. And, you know, they're asking me questions and what happened and all this other stuff.
Please tell me you went to the hospital this time.
So this time I actually went to the hospital. I had no choice. They drug me away. Or I probably wouldn't have gone on myself. But so they got me to the hospital there in Plano, Texas. The next thing I know, I got doctors. I got nurses. I had maintenance men coming in to rub me. They go, can we rub you? Can we touch you? I'm going, okay.
Yeah, it's a little strange.
You know what? So finally I looked at the nurse. I said, why are all these people coming in to touch me? She goes, oh, you should be dead. There is just absolutely no reason on earth you're alive. None. You must have a purpose. I never understood that I got a purpose. I just, you know, how do you relate that into terms that you got a purpose? Now I kind of think I know that I was meant to save some lives in this lifetime. I was meant to write a book. You can see my grandmother there, my seventh great grandmother. I'm an author. I wrote a book called, or a novel called, Woman of Many Names.
We're going to get to that in just a little while, by the way.
Yeah, I sort of led a parallel life with her as well. So
I want to go back a little bit and get a little bit more detail from this experience with Grandma. You mentioned to me the other day, you also saw colors. Explain that. Where were the colors and what were they like?
I have to tell you that when you cross over to the other side, for me, it's here. Heaven, the next life, it's all right here on this planet. We're not going to fly off to someplace in the sky unless that happens after the rapture or something. I don't know, but it's here. What I saw was heaven. And the colors were so bright and so vivid, and everything is clean. When you step over, it's just clean. It's not dirty. It's not, there's no trash. It's just like we're seeing it with what it was meant to be at the creation. The colors were so alive that you could like almost taste them, I want to say. It was just very vivid, very bright. It smelled good. I could smell my grandmother. I could smell the earth. I could, from far away, I could smell the flowers that were there. And the sunlight was just perfect. Everything is perfect there, as far as that all goes.
So you're seeing colors in what? Are you seeing the sky? Are you seeing a landscape?
The sky, the grass, the flowers, the trees, the vibrancy of all of it was incomparable. And like I said, I'm a retired landscaper. I grew up working with all those materials. I could never match that sight that day. It's hard to explain to people what something's like if they've never experienced it. It's hard because you're going, oh yeah, whatever. But it changes you. It changes the way you feel about pretty darn near everything. I'm not afraid to die. I look forward to it. If you can say that, you know, I know it's not going to be a scary place. It's going to be a place we go to be with our family. They're going to be there to get us. They're going to be there to get you.
Tell me more about Grandma. You said she looked different. In what way?
She did. It wasn't like you could see the full face. It was, you know, there was a face there somewhere, but you just couldn't quite make it out. But I could see her eyes. All I could see was her eyes. And when I heard her voice, I knew it was her. And with that voice came her smell, what she smelled like. I think it reassured me. It let me know for sure it was her.
Okay. I appreciate it. I know you can't go any deeper. So we will move on. How has this, you said this changed your life, that you found a purpose. Give me an idea of what some of those things are.
I knew I needed to make the world a prettier place. And to take care of animals and to just be a better person, be a kinder person. I always had an affinity for animals. Animals have always been drawn to me from, you know, little bitty right on up, all except for that buffalo. That buffalo wasn't a good deal. But other than that, even wild animals, you know, just don't seem to be afraid of me. You know, you always have to have a, especially when you're interacting with wild animals and wolves and stuff, you have to have a healthy respect for them. If you're afraid, they're going to sense that fear. And because you emit, you know, a smell when you're afraid. I mean, a lot of people don't believe in that, but you do. You literally emit an odor that they can smell.
All right. You've already told me you have no fear of death, which takes away one of the questions that I often ask people. So thanks a lot for stealing my thunder. Tell me a little bit about the book, because we get all kinds of people on here that write books about their near-death experience. It's a great way for them to share it. That's not what your book is about. Tell us about it.
Well, I'm a little bit Cherokee Indian. I'm actually a Cherokee citizen. Recent Cherokee citizen. I just got my citizenship about last October of 23. And I'm, you know, of course, very proud of that. My ancestry was hidden from me until I was around 12 years old. And I I'm a dreamer. I've always had very vivid dreams, and sometimes they're so vivid, I think they're real. There's been times that I have difficulty discerning what was a dream and what was real after, you know, you wake up. I kept having a repetitive dream about a Native American woman standing on top of a hill, and she's looking down at a valley. And in that valley, you can see, you know, dwellings, Native American dwellings. And after the second time I had the dream, I said to my mom, I said, I keep having this dream. And she said, oh, well, that's interesting. About the fourth time I had the same exact dream, I went to her and I said, Mom, I keep having the same dream. I've had it like four or five times now, Mom. Why am I having this dream? She goes, all right, you're Cherokee Indian, and don't you tell a soul. Don't you tell a soul. I said, oh, my gosh, that's, it's like things click, 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 up. Whoa, because that, about that time I had learned that not everybody saw ghosts. Not everybody felt presences. Not everybody had precognition and so on and so forth. I said, oh, okay. So I absolutely, I went to school the next day. I told anybody that would listen, I was Cherokee Indian, that I'm not Italian. Oh, you must be Italian. I'm going, I don't know what we are. Scotch and Irish is all I know. So anyway, Scotch, Irish, and Indian, a dozen other secret ingredients, don't you know?
So how did you write a book about your seventh great grandmother? Where did you find research for this?
Well, what happened was as soon as I found out I was Cherokee, I went to my grandpa and I said, why haven't you ever told me that you are Cherokee Indian? He says, well, you know, Deborah, he says, you know, we had a really hard time. They killed off a lot of our family. They locked us up on a reservation in the middle of nowhere where we were not meant to thrive or survive. He goes, and the reason, you know, that I don't talk about it is, he says, because if the United States government declares war on us again, I got to go back to that reservation and live. I have no choice. He says, so I've held it secret for a long time since we moved to Ohio. I figured nobody needed to know we were Native American because I live prejudice. Your mother, I didn't want that for my kids. And at that point, he started telling me stories. So my grandfather was telling me the stories about his mother and his father and his famous grandmother. He called her Nani all the time. He just called her Nani. And he said Nani was famous and that she worked to help save the people and that she did great things in her lifetime and that she was a sensitive. Basically, he said, you know, she had the gift of sight and would tell me these stories about Nanihi. He never called her Nancy Ward. He always called her Nanihi or Nani, and which he used as like a grandmother word. At some juncture, I just felt that it was important for him to tell me these stories. And I'd have him say, tell me the stories again, Grandpa. Tell me the stories again. So he repeatedly told me those stories of his grandmother. And then when I was on my way through Oklahoma to my way to Texas, I stopped there and in the Okmulgee area and Broken Arrow and met my other aunts and uncles, and they told me more stories. So it's like, you know how you just put things away in your brain and you think, you know, these stories, you know, are important to me, but my brother wasn't interested in our ancestry. My mother most certainly was not. She was, I hate to say it, but sometimes I felt like she was ashamed, you know, and then there's me, you know, all proud and happy about it.
So she was very famous.
Oh my gosh, yeah.
Would you call this book strictly historical or is it more of a historical novel?
It is a kind of like a biography in a lot of ways. Like I said, I'm telling things that were passed down in my family for generations.
Yeah.
As well as what I could glean, you know, from white man's literature and so on and so forth. So it's actually historical fiction, which I had to do, number one, because the Smithsonian got me thinking. And then I talked to my attorney and he said, well, just to be on the safe side, you are going to go historical fiction. I said, fine with me. I don't care. As long as this story is out there, I don't care.
Yeah. Let me ask you one final question. You've lived a life full of adventure and learning and some really hard experiences as well. Do you have any last thoughts or message that you'd like to leave our listeners? I'd love to be able to give people some kind of nice breath of hope today.
Don't give up. Just don't give up. We all endure pain. And I've imparted a lot on you. As a spiritualist, as a portal person, as somebody that's seen the other side and not afraid of it, I've wanted to go several times with my own help. And the pain that we feel when we're at our lowest, it's so hard to see past. You cannot imagine that in 2 days, 3 days, 3 weeks, 3 months, 3 years, that you're not going to feel that pain that makes you want to go. Hang on. Work your way through those times that you don't feel like you belong here, because you do. You do. We belong here until the Lord calls us home. I made promises after my last attempt to never to try to go again. And I've lived up to that promise, even though there's days that, you know, that I wanted to go so bad and I'd beg God, please, 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 please take me home. I just want to be with you. I want peace. I don't want any more hurt. No more hurt. And I remember after one time, I took off running. And I took off running barefoot. And I went probably a good half a mile barefooted on a stone road. In the days and weeks following that, of course, I was in a lot of pain because my feet were completely bruised from running on rocks. And as clear as day, I heard the Lord say, be thankful that you can feel that pain. Don't ever do it again. And he has brought me through times that I just didn't think anybody could survive. I've had one of those lives like Nancy Ward had, of people who have tried to kill me multiple times. And I don't know why, because I'm really a decent person. You know, I won't say I'm the greatest person, but I'm a decent person. And people have wanted me dead. You know, and it's hard sometimes to wrap your brain around not only my wanting myself gone, but that somebody else would want me gone when I did nothing but try to help them and make their lives better. So hang on even through those tough times, because God has a purpose for you.
Well, Deborah, thanks so much. And let me ask you one quick thing. Someday in the future, will you introduce me to your grandmother? She sounds awesome.
Oh, I wish I could. I wish I could.
You'll be able to.
We will. We'll all commune together one day.
That's right.
Won't it be amazing? Won't it be amazing? It'll be beautiful.
Thanks for being on the show.
Thank you, Eric.
Thanks again for listening and sharing this podcast. Don't forget to hit the follow or subscribe button and sign up for our newsletter at roundtripdeath.com. If you want to share your near-death experience, or if you have questions or comments about the show, send an email to eric@roundtripdeath.com. Until then, I wish you everything good that you're looking for in this life and the next.